nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So today I'd like to continue with our discussion of this principle of band structure. And again, just to remind you of the big picture of what we're doing, to model any device, you need density of states. To get density of states, you start from Schrodinger equation. And what we are currently discussing is kind of an intermediate step, like how do you get from a Schrodinger equation to a density of states? That's what you're kind of where we are. And the process is the Schrodinger equation in its usual form is a differential equation. That's a differential operator. So first step is you assume some set of basis functions, and the differential equation then becomes a matrix equation. And instead of having a function, you have a set of numbers. The numbers that tell you the coefficients of that expansion. That is, you're thinking of that function as a linear combination of certain basis functions. And the elements of that tell you the coefficients of that expansion. And this is a matrix. And as you have discussed, the first principles method would be you try to calculate this matrix by performing certain integrals starting from that operator. But more commonly, what's used is a semi-empirical method where the elements of this matrix are taken from various experimental and theoretical information that's available. So you have that matrix, and what we now want to do is find the eigenvalues. Ordinarily, you'd have to go to a computer, and it'd be a huge matrix because the size of the matrix is at least the number of atoms in your solid. And usually, you'd have more than one basis function per atom. So actually it is. So if you had, say, 10 basis functions per atom, the size of that matrix would be like 10 times the number of atoms, for example. So in general, that can be a huge matrix. But the principle of band structure, which we are discussing now, what it allows you to do is to write down the eigenvalues of that matrix without going to a computer, just analytically almost. And we are kind of in the middle of that discussion. In other words, we have covered some part of it. But what we'll do today would kind of complete that, complete the whole story. So what we discussed was a problem where it could be a problem in one dimension, like just a solid composed of a one-dimensional array of hydrogen atoms, or it could be a two-dimensional problem or three-dimensional problem where atoms are arranged in some periodic fashion, right?
Yeah. If we dock the channel, how does that affect these formulas?
How does it affect the
density formula? Does that affect?
Right. Now, this doping, I'd like to keep it separate because the way you visualize the doping is, let's say you're doping a silicon channel. Now, the number of atoms you introduce is like 1 in a million. Or less. So the thing is, when you're talking about the density of states of that channel, if you are never worried about the dopants, you'd get it about right. Because instinctively you can see that, I mean, in that solid, you have changed just 1 in a million. You see? Now, so the way people think is, they first think of the periodic, clean periodic solid. No dopants. That's like your baseline to start from. Then you ask the question, well, now, if I had a little impurity in there, like a phosphorus atom or an arsenic atom, what difference would it make? And the difference could be that the clean thing is like this, and the presence of an arsenic atom might give you one level around there, let's say. That's typically what a shallow donor does. Or if it's a shallow acceptor, it might give you one thing there. But that's a separate problem. This principle of band structure we are talking about, you couldn't use it directly to handle that problem because the dopants are usually randomly placed. They're not in any particular periodic, they don't have any particular periodic ordering. So you couldn't use that principle as it. And if it so happened that you had a solid where dopants were periodically placed like that, then you could probably think of the unit cell as something like this. which has silicon atoms and one dopant. And then you could say, okay, this I'm repeating over and over. And then you could probably apply the principle of band structure to such a problem. That sometimes people do, actually. So what you have discussed so far then is we started with the 1D solid, and then we talked about the 2D thing. And it doesn't matter whether it's 1D, 2D, or 3D. The basic principle would be that here's the equation you are trying to solve. That's a matrix equation. You could write it in terms of the elements of phi in this way. So this represents an entire set of algebraic equations which are equivalent to. That's an equivalent way of writing that matrix. I mean, this is kind of a shorthand notation for that. So H times phi really means this. Now, and if you put n equals 1, you'll get one equation, n equals 2, another one, n equals 3, etc. And the thing about a periodic solid is that if you write the solution in this form, it allows you to solve this entire set of equations. And if you take that, substitute it in here, you get that condition, and you can drop this phi 0 from both sides, and what you'd end up with then is E is equal to this. So if you knew these elements, this H and M, you can just evaluate this summation, and you'd have the EK relationship for any solid, 1D, 2D, 3D, all the same. Right? So that's the general principle. Now, there's one thing that's missing here in this principle. One additional refinement or sophistication that we need, and that's what I'll be discussing today. And that would then kind of complete the story. So this additional refinement has to do with the following, that often you don't really have one basis function per unit cell, because what we have discussed here so far is like one basis function per unit cell like this. So that, like, if you take this original problem that we are discussing, for example, the 1D problem, you have an epsilon here and a T that couples the nearest neighbors. And so the corresponding matrix looks something like epsilon, epsilon, epsilon down the line with T's off diagonal. You know, T's on the upper diagonal and T's on the lower diagonal, epsilon's along the diagonal. And what allowed you to use this principle of band structure was the fact that every line looks the same. That's what really makes this kind of a solution work. Because you see, I'm telling you to apply this formula, that how do you calculate EK? Well, this is how you do it. So you say, well, but there's an N there. What N do I use? I mean, after all, I should get an EK relationship independent of what N I use. And the point is, that is only true because we are talking about a periodic solid. You could take a solid, stand anywhere you want, any N, and do your summation around that N. And the answer would be the same because it's a perfectly periodic solid. You could stand here, here, here. And because you're using periodic boundary conditions, even the edges are the same. You could stand right near the edge, you'd still get to the much the same answer. See? That's what makes it work. Otherwise, of course, every N would have given you a different answer. It's not good. Now, that's the problem you'd run into if you tried to apply that principle directly to a solid where, let's say, it kind of looks like this, but slightly different. Namely, you got two atoms next to each other, and the next one is a little further apart. So it's, let's say, T here, but it's T prime here, and then again T, and then again T prime. So the atoms come in twos. So what that means is, when I'm trying to write this thing, there's a difference between a site like this, which I'll call an A site, and a site like that, which I can call a B site. Because if I stand at a B site, I'll see T to the left and T prime to the right. But if I stand at A, it's T prime to the left and T to the right. So B is different from A. So if you try to apply a principle like this directly, you can see right away it won't work. Because how am I going to do the summation? Should I put my n at the A site or at the B site? I'll get a different answer depending on what I do. You see? And you can see that from the matrix also. It's like you're going A, B, A, B, etc. So when you're on a B site, it's like the T to the left or T prime here. But this one is like reversed, T prime and T, and so on. Right? So because you are trying to write, you know, this is an A site, a B site, and again an A site, and again a B site, etc. Now the way around this is to, again, go to this concept of a unit cell, namely that you can take two of these and view it as one unit. In terms of this matrix, it's like you're breaking up this matrix into little 2x2 things, like that. And now you'll notice that this looks just like that. And this is exactly like this, but it's transposed. I mean, it's a T prime here, it's a T prime there. It's transposed. That's because, of course, all these H matrices that you'll always run into will be Hermitian. Hermitian means it's equal to its conjugate transpose. And in this discussion, since we're thinking of real things, real numbers, real elements, what it means is this would be the transpose of that. In general, has to be the conjugate transpose. Here it's just transpose. Yes, please.
What about the boundaries?
Right. Same story. You'd have to assume it's a periodic boundary conditions so that when you finally get here, and let's say that's where it terminates, then you kind of think of this as being the first one up back here. So as if, again, it's tied in a chain. So in order to apply the principle of band structure, you'd always have to assume this periodic boundary. So there's effectively no edges anymore. No matter where you go, it looks the same. That's the essential principle. And of course, as I've mentioned before, real solids are seldom like that. As I said, the only example I know is this carbon nanotube, where actually a graphite sheet is rolled up in a cylinder. That's the only place where you really have a periodic boundary condition. So most of the time, the justification for periodic boundary conditions is a physical one. Namely, that often people are trying to think about the properties of a large solid, and it's a bulk property that is independent of the surface. That they know just from physical considerations, that if you had a piece of silicon like this, and you're trying to figure out some properties of silicon, it won't depend on exactly what the condition of the surface is. This is a property that's independent of those exact boundary conditions. So the idea is that, well, since we are physically know that boundary conditions shouldn't matter, let's assume the boundary conditions to be whatever makes our life mathematically the simplest. And that's the periodic boundary condition. So that's the usual justification. And the thing to remember always is when you get to really small structures, unless it's you really have periodic boundary conditions, you can't justify it. Which is why, when you get to small things, people worry a lot about surface effects. You know, what does it do to your density of states? As you know, near a surface, actually, you can get all kinds of surface states here, which people have to worry about. And they make a difference to actual behavior. Okay? But here, what we are discussing is this principle of band structure, which is widely used and, you know, to extract the basic density of states of that clean periodic structure. Okay, so the important conceptual jump here is to think of, to go from the idea of atoms being the unit to the idea that there's a unit cell, which in principle could have two basis functions, you know, one here and one there, or it could be much more actually. Even if you had just one atom per unit cell, you could always have more than one basis function, because on that atom you could be using a S level and a P level and all that as your basis functions. So you could have a pretty large number of basis functions per atom. See? But the point is this concept of a unit cell. So the idea is that in general, a solid will have n unit cell, and each unit cell will have, say, b number of basis functions. And overall, the size of the matrix that we are dealing with, that matrix, its overall size is nb times nb. So let's say two basis functions per atom, per unit cell, and 100 unit cells. So that would make it 200 by 200. So the size of that matrix is really nb by nb. Right? And so everything we have done so far, the assumption was b was 1. So this is the important jump we have to make conceptually. Okay. Now, so now if you want to make use of the property that each unit cell looks the same, that as long if I stand anywhere within a unit cell at this point, it'll look exactly the same as if I went to another unit cell, as long as I stand at the kind of this corresponding point there. So no matter which unit cell you go to, as long as you stand, say, right in the middle, or right to the left, or just to the right, whatever it is, you know, one fixed point within that unit cell, it'll look exactly the same, no matter where you go. That's the concept. Okay. So what that means is, so in order to make use of that, what we can do is I can take this and write, when I write it like this, the way I write it is the following. This phi, here this phi n was just a number. But now the way to think of it is, this phi is a column vector. Now I put an n there, put an nm here. Put an m there. So you might say, well, what happened here? I mean, after all, once I put this nth element of phi, it should not be a column vector anymore. It should be a number. No, but the way I'm thinking is, this is the nth unit cell. So when I write the wave function in the nth unit cell, it has got two components already. Two are, you know, if you have 10 basis functions, there will be 10 components. So the idea is, you know, this is multiplied by phi, and the phi goes like 1a, phi 1b, and then phi 2a, and then phi 2b, because there's an a site and a b site. So when I write phi 1, let's say n equals 1, what I really mean is a column vector whose size is 2 by 1. So it's got an a component and a b component. And if there were 10 basis functions, it would actually have 10 components, whatever it is. So this phi n then, it's a column vector whose size is b by 1. That column vector, that's also b by 1. Now, what's the size of this hnm? If I'm looking at a particular element nm of this matrix, what's the size of hnm? B by B. I mean, which is a lot smaller than that, of course, because n is usually a huge number, number of unit cells in the solid. That's a huge number. So this is a whole lot smaller matrix than that one. But the important conceptual point is, although I'm talking of HNM, it's still a matrix, not a number, because it tells you how to connect these various B elements, all these B elements, B number of elements with those B number of elements. So, you know, as we do a couple of examples, you'll see how that works. Now, the principle of band structure then says is that, you see, because it's all periodic again, that is, H, NM, no matter where you go in the solid, that matrix looks the same. The point that I made, that no matter where you go, that matrix is the same as that matrix, is the same as the next matrix, and so on. No matter which one you look at, all these matrices look the same. So what you are allowed to do, so the principle of band structure, what it tells you is, you cannot write phi n equals phi 0. The point is you can write it like this, where this is now a b by 1 column vector. This is also a b by 1 column vector. This principle will then solve that set of equations. Yeah.
E will remain as a single value, or as a scalar?
As a single number, because We are still trying to solve that equation. We are still trying to find the eigenvalues of that full matrix.
So in this case, will E represent the eigenvalue of the unit cell or the...
No, eigenvalue belongs to the entire solid, always, right? So it's like if this is a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix, there are 1,000 eigenvalues, but each eigenvalue is kind of a property of the entire solid, right? Each eigenvalue contributes something to the density of states. And these density of states belong to the entire solid. One of the concepts we'll get into a little later, say early in November, is the concept of a local density of states. How you take a solid and ask the question, what is the density of states here or there? But at this time, what we are doing is we are talking about the density of states in the whole thing. Okay. So the principle of band structure then, the modified principle, looks like this. Kind of looks superficially like what we had before, except that phi n is now itself a b by 1 column vector. Okay? So now if I substitute this in here, what will happen is, again, I'll get exactly the same answer, looking kind of similar, except that this will now be phi 0. And this will be also phi 0. And this is actually a matrix. So formally looks similar. You see, I should probably write it as like what I had written there. H, but the NM component, yeah. And this, of course, is a B by B matrix. So you see, after substituting our solution, what we get is still a matrix equation. We started from a matrix equation. Last time, this had become just an expression. It was E equals something. That's it. Done. But now you see, this is still a matrix equation, but it's a whole lot smaller, though, because this was NB by NB. How big is this matrix equation? It's just, we are talking about a B by B matrix. Once you have chosen a particular value of K, it's just a B by B matrix, which is a whole lot smaller. As I said, because n is usually a huge number. Okay. So the way this works is that the equation you are finally getting looks like this. So the way the overall procedure then would work is, last time it was like, this was the final answer, Ek is equal to HNM this, and you just do a summation, you're done. Now you see, if you do that summation, you still get a B by B matrix. That's what I've called H of K. For a given K, you end up with something that is itself a B by B matrix. And the overall equation then looks like this. Last time, of course, you just canceled the phi 0. Now it's a B by B matrix. You can't just cancel the phi 0. That wouldn't make any sense. But you have this B by B matrix equation, and you have to find its eigenvalues. So the way this would work now is, last time when we were doing this, problem with a single line of atoms, we came out with a E of K. That looked, I believe, something like this. And then we identified the Brevand zone and said these are the eigenvalues. Now the way it will work is, if you had, say, 2 atoms per unit cell, then for every k, I'd have a 2x2 matrix equation. And so if I look for the eigenvalues, I'd actually get 2 eigenvalues for every k. So what I'd do is I'd go to a particular k, and I would say, OK, I got 1 eigenvalue here, and let's say another one somewhere here. So I'd have 2 eigenvalues. And then I'd go to another point and say, OK, I got 2 eigenvalues. So, and this way, I'd then join these all up. And the overall band structure would then have 2 branches. See, so for every k, there are 2 eigenvalues. Another k, there's 2 eigenvalues. So the way it works is, I choose a k. As soon as I choose a k, I can sum this up. As a result, I get a 2x2 matrix, which gives me 2 eigenvalues. So every k, 2 eigenvalues. In general, then, every k, there will be b number of eigenvalues, number of basis functions. I mean, 2 was just the example here. And how many points in k in every Brevand zone? Well, that's equal to the number of unit cells, following the same principle as before, n. So how many eigenvalues do I get at the end of the day? N times b, which is, of course, what I get. Because remember, I'm trying to find an analytical way to write down the eigenvalues of that matrix, which is nb by nb. It should have nb eigenvalues. It's just that now it's like there are n values of k, and for every k, there's b eigenvalues. And so finally, I've got all nb of that, right? Yes.
Why these two solutions are symmetric?
Need not be. The example I'll go through, I think they will come out symmetric, but that's just an accident. I mean, need not be. In general, when you look at any solid, you look at the band structure, they draw it along specific direction in k, and you see all these various branches to it, and there's no symmetry in there. Right. There will be, if you had 4 basis functions per unit cell, there would be 4 branches to it. So typical semiconductors, usually there's many branches, you know, 10 of them, quite common.
Is that the so-called sub-bands?
No, sub-bands is a separate concept that we'll come to later. This is still bands. That's it. So what I'll do is, this gets a little clearer. Because the principle, I think, I've just stated it. This is it, the principle. And this, I would say, is the final result of band structure. This is it. That once you are given H, choose a K, find H of K, find the eigenvalues of that, and that will give you the eigenvalues, all the eigenvalues of the matrix. That's the overall principle, really. That's it. And what we had done last day was a special case of this, where you had only 1 basis function per unit cell, and so this became a number. Instead of being a B by B matrix, it just became a 1x1 matrix, which is like a number. And so there was no further eigenvalues to find. I mean, it's a 1x1 matrix. I mean, that's the eigenvalue. So this was it. EK, you're done. Now it's a little more complicated. So this will hopefully get a little clearer when I go through one example, namely this problem with 2 atoms per unit cell. So let's just do that in the rest of the class. And what I'm trying to do is showing you how to apply that equation. That's all. So the problem we are trying to do is, has these 2 atoms close to each other, and then again 2 atoms a little far from each other. So every time, so epsilon is the diagonal element, but it's t to one side and t prime to the other side. Right? So first thing is identify your unit cells. So one natural way of doing it would be this is a unit cell, that's a unit cell, and so on. So the next rule is I need to write the small h of k. For a given value k, we have to write down that matrix. And I do it by doing this summation. So last day, we kind of went through this discussion of how to do that summation when this was just a number, not a matrix. So what I'll now do is, again, how to write that summation when it's a matrix. So what we're trying to do is write H of k, and this is a 1D problem, so I won't bother to write k with a vector on it. It's basically, there's only one direction to talk about. You could call it x or z, whatever you like. So h is just, k is just in that direction, whatever it is. Okay. Good. So we want to write that summation. Now, first question, how many terms in that sum? The principle is you stand at any point n and do a sum over all m's. So in principle, of course, it's all over all the unit cells around. But in practice, you don't have to write all the unit cells. How many? Right. One to the left, one to the right. And the easiest one is, of course, itself, when m is equal to n. So there's always these three terms. So let's always, first thing to write is what's right there. So how do we write, then, the HNM when m is equal to n? So basically what we are trying to do is write HNN. But the problem is HNN itself is now a 2x2 matrix. Last time it was a number, epsilon. Now it's itself a 2x2 matrix because every unit cell has these two elements to it, A, B. So what we have to write down is this matrix that connects NA, NB with NA and NB. So we are standing at point N. This is the A-th element. This is the B-th element. Epsilon's on the diagonal. These couplings are T. So can you help me write that matrix? What's on the diagonal? Just epsilon. Nth unit cell, Ath element, diagonal element, that's just epsilon. Here what I need is whatever it is that connects Na with Nb. What is that? T. That's it. So this is easy. And no phase factors because m is equal to n. Remember, only time you really get into phase factors is once m is different from n. Okay, good. So next we can try to write, let's say, n and n plus 1 or minus 1. Let's take the n plus 1. So n, n plus 1. We want to write that matrix. Again, n has an A site and a B site. N plus 1 has an A site and a B site. And you have to fill that out. So first question, what's this number here? Right, so this is the n plus 1 site. This is the n site, A and B. So we're trying to find what is it that connects Na with n plus 1a. Well, no connections, no direct connection. Of course, if you had a model in which you had things going out to the next nearest neighbor, you'd have something. But our models, nothing there. So that's a zero. Now, what about Na with n plus 1b? Well, that's even smaller. That's way out there someplace. NB and N plus 1A. Now you're talking of NB connected with N plus 1A. Well, there's a definite connection there. That's T prime. And then NB with N plus 1B. No connections. That's this one and that one. Okay, so that's a matrix. Now for the phase factor, e to the power I k, and then this dm minus dn. Remember, what that really means is the vector that runs from the nth unit cell to wherever you're looking. So it's that vector, which is in the same direction x as k. So you'd get e to the power I k times whatever that distance is. You know, if I call that d, it will be e to the power I k d. I could have called it a. It's just that in the past, I had used a for the distance from one atom to the other, and I don't want to confuse it. Because now it's the distance from one unit cell to the other. That's all. This I k d. Done. One more term, and we'll be done. And that's the one where it's n and n minus 1. So now we are looking to the left. Now you can convince yourself that this one also will have only one non-zero element. You know, just as this one had only one, 3 was 0. Here also there's only one non-zero element. Question is which one? You think about it. It's this connection, the NA to the N minus 1B connection. Because of that. That's the only connection going running from the nth unit cell to the N minus 1 unit cell. It's the NA and the N minus 1B. Which really means upper right. So you put a T prime there. So notice those two matrices are not the same. It's a little different. But actually one is the transpose of the other. In general, one would be the transpose conjugate of the other. But now what about the phase factor? Instead of this vector, we are now talking of that vector. And that's in the opposite direction to x, and k is in x direction. So e to the power minus ikd. That's it. So this is h of k. So 2 by 2 matrix. For any given k, you could write it down. If you write out this matrix, then, so I've got these three matrices to add up. This, this, this. And of course, at the end of the day, I'll still have a 2 by 2 matrix. That's what I really want. So can you help me with what are the diagonal elements first? It's just epsilon. Why? Because it's 0 out here. So these two guys don't contribute anything. Remember, when I'm adding matrices and I want, say, the AA element, I just add the AA element of all three. Similarly, if I want this, I take the BB elements of all three. And since these are just zeros, all that matters is what's right there. That's it. Nothing to talk about. Okay. Now let's try the AB. Try to write the AB element, which means this one. Right. So you get a T from here, nothing from there, and a T prime from there. Now, what about the BA? T prime to the power IKD, nothing here. Right? That's it. Now you'll notice that the equation I get at the end of the day, I think this is plus, right? Yeah. Is this Hermitian, by the way? It is, that's an important point to note, that this is Hermitian, because Hermitian means it's equal to its conjugate transpose. So in order for a matrix to be equal to its conjugate transpose, every diagonal element must be real. Off-diagonal elements can be complex, but then whatever appears there should be the conjugate of whatever appears here. And the fact, this is a complex number. Although we started with real numbers, the thing is the h of k is a complex number that you're getting here. But it's still Hermitian in the sense there's a minus there, but when you take the complex conjugates, that's a plus. And these t's and t primes, of course, I assume they were real to start with. If they were complex to start with, then you'd have got the complex conjugates here if you had gone through it. Okay? But I assume that those things were real to start with. Okay, so that's the matrix. That's the h of k. So in general, that's the method then. Given any structure, you stand at any point n, perform this summation. And because of the periodicity of the solid, it doesn't matter where you stand. So just choose a convenient place and do this summation. Okay. Now, so this is h of k, but we are not done yet, in the sense that, you see, we are looking for eigenvalues. So I still have a 2 by 2 matrix. So what are the eigenvalues of that matrix? How do I find it? As you know, usual rule is any matrix times some eigenvector is equal to a number times some eigenvector. And then you try to solve that. So usually what you do is you could say something like E times some eigenvector, like I wrote there, is equal to that matrix times that same eigenvector. And then you often, like if you want to, you could bring the E over to that side and you could write it something like this. I'll give that a name. Rather than write it over and over, let me write it as, say, this alpha I haven't used, right? So put alpha, and then what is this in terms of alpha? Alpha complex conjugate. So this thing here, then, I've just given it a name, that's all. I just called it alpha. You know, rather than writing that thing over and over, let me just write that. So this, multiplying an eigenvector, should be equal to 0. So E times a some 2 by 1 column vector is equal to that matrix times a 2 by 1 column vector. And you could bring the E over to this side, as you know, and this will become epsilon minus E. This would be epsilon minus E. And what's the next step? I mean, this you have seen before, right? I'm just going through it because, you know, it may be rusty. So what is it? And especially if you're using MATLAB for most things, I mean, you should be sure that you can do a 2 by 2. In this class, I won't ask you to do a 3 by 3 or anything more than that. Though I know usually there are some people who can do that pretty faster than me. But at least a 2 by 2 you should all be able to do. And remember what it is. So what's the next step? You set the determinant to 0. Right? And when you set the determinant to 0, you get a quadratic equation. Because it's a 2 by 2, it's a quadratic. If it's 3 by 3, it would be a cubic and so on. So you'd get a quadratic equation, which will have two roots, and those are your two eigenvalues. And those are the two values of E for which you can find a non-trivial solution, non-trivial vector, such that this times that vector is 0. What do I mean by non-trivial? Well, because one obvious answer is always this. That's called the trivial solution. That doesn't matter what E is. This times 0 is 0. That's not a problem. That's a trivial solution. What we're looking for is non-trivial solution, where it's non-zero things, which multiplied by this would give you 0. Right? And that is only possible for two special values of E. And that's what basically I... So when you ask MATLAB to find the eigenvalues of that matrix, it has all kinds of sophisticated algorithms inside to do this, essentially. Okay. So what's the determinant of that matrix? It's this times this minus tetra. So it's like epsilon minus E square minus alpha alpha star, which is like alpha magnitude squared, if you like, or alpha alpha star, whatever you mean, equals 0. So epsilon minus E is equal to plus or minus magnitude of alpha. And so the allowed eigenvalues are So this is a result worth remembering in general, that with 2x2 matrices, if both of those are equal, then your eigenvalues are just this plus the magnitude of that, and this minus the magnitude of that. Okay? That's what you get. You see epsilon plus alpha and epsilon minus alpha. And it wouldn't be quite so simple, it would be a little more work, if those epsilons hadn't been equal, if it had been epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. Okay? But if those are equal, then this is a simple result to remember, really. Okay. So the eigenvalues then, I can write down easily, E equals epsilon plus minus magnitude of that quantity, which amounts to t plus t prime e to the power minus I k d. So the way you find this magnitude is you take whatever you have, multiply it by its complex conjugate, and take the square root of that. So you take this, multiply it by its complex conjugate, and then take the square root. That's it. So that amounts to, so I've got this times this, I'll get four terms. I'll get t times t, that's a t square. I get the t prime exponential times t prime exponential plus. Those phase factors will cancel, giving me a t prime square. And then I'll get a t times t prime with this quantity. And a t times t prime with that one. That's it. So that gets me to the final result, which is E is equal to epsilon plus minus square root of t square plus t prime square plus 2t t prime cosine kt. This is it. So note that for every value of k, I now got two eigenvalues, epsilon plus this and epsilon minus this. And as I mentioned before, this is one case, it comes out symmetrically. In the sense it's this plus something and this minus something. Need not have worked out that way. So if I now plot this as a function of k, you'd end up looking something like this. So this is k. And again, k runs from minus pi over d to plus pi over d. Usually, and that comes from this Brevand's own idea of the coming from this periodic boundary condition, coming from the same idea that we had agreed before. But the thing is, for every k, then we have epsilon plus something and epsilon minus something. So I think one of them would probably look something like this, another would look something like that. So can you tell me the values at k equals 0 quickly? So if k equals 0, then you see cosine kd is 1. And then you see this looks like a perfect square, t plus t prime square. So when I take the square root, it's t plus t prime. So what that means is, I mean, this line is epsilon. So it's epsilon plus something and epsilon minus something. So at k equals 0, this point will be like t plus t prime above epsilon. I mean, it's epsilon plus that. Now, what about the pi point? Can you tell me what is this? That's where kd is pi. So cosine kd is minus 1. So again, it's a perfect square. So this is like t minus t prime. So this point is like epsilon plus t minus t prime. And this is, of course, epsilon minus that plus. That's it. So this is a good, you know, simple example to see. And what I'd asked you to in one of the homework problems is to show that, you see, to compare these two cases. One is that supposing you have a solid where all these atoms are lined up periodically. There's no T and no T prime. I mean, those are all equal. And we know how to do the band structure for that. But supposing you decide to use two of these as your unit cell. You don't have to, because the unit cell is really just one of them. But supposing you decide to use two of them and use this principle, the point is, at the end of the day, you should get the same answer. And what I ask you in this homework problem is to do it both ways and convince yourself it's the same answer. See, and that's a good example to sort of go through to get a feeling for how this works. Okay?